The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I want to start off with, has anyone heard of a short story written by Kurt Vonnegut a long time ago called Harrison Bergeron?
Yeah.
Be familiar? This is how this story begins. The year was 2081 and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. And in Harrison Bergeron, the dystopian future, equality is achieved by basically bringing everybody down to the lowest common denominator, right? So if you're judged to be attractive, you have to wear a mask. If you're smart, you have a siren that goes off in your head every 10 seconds. And because it's Kurt Vonnegut, there's some definitely darkly funny moments in the story. There's a ballet performance where, because they're all talented dancers, they're all shackled with weights, so they're not better dancers than the average person. But in general, unfortunately, because Vonnegut wrote some great stuff, it's a pretty reactionary little story, because basically the whole premise is that the only way you can achieve equality is by bringing talented people down to the sort of mediocre level of the masses, right? And that kind of elitism in that, I think it's a common element of a lot of the sort of portrayals we get of socialism as sort of a dreary dystopia that you get in science fiction and other things. I think partly it comes from the experience that many artists and intellectuals have under capitalism, where they have this unique role where they get to express their individuality. And so the assumption is in some future where we're all workers, that ability to express your own ideas and challenging ideas will be gone. And so, like, we'll all be reduced to being unable to express that. But I think the idea that socialism is some boring, dreary future is also a reflection of many societies that call themselves socialist throughout the 20th century. I don't want to give a whole long history of Stalinism, but there's just one kind of minor example that I find pretty telling, which was after the fall of the Berlin Wall. In 1990, the Rolling Stones played this sort of legendary concert in Prague where people just went nuts that finally they got to hear the Rolling Stones. The sad part is, I know a lot of you guys are much younger, but the Rolling Stones by 1990 sucked. Like, their most recent song had been this thing called Harlem Shuffle. If you listen to it, Prague, you talk about Prague, like one of the coolest cities in the world, and people are like starved to like watch 50-year-old Mick Jagger, right? That doesn't speak well to the cultural, you know, to what kind of dynamic, thriving society existed in Eastern Europe. I know it's not the most important example, but I feel like it speaks to something dire. Okay, fine. So there's a perception that socialism out there, that socialism is boring. How important is that, right? I mean, why give a talk on this compared to other talks? I would turn that around. You guys are the ones who came here. You can think about all the amazing talks you could be here right now. Something a little wrong with you guys. But for real, I mean, I do think that it's legitimate to say there might be something silly or even almost offensive about this question, right? As if boredom is like one of the biggest problems compared to the horrors that capitalism inflicts on people, right? You think about the trauma of losing your home, of losing your job, of being raped. You know what I mean? There's all sorts of horrors where, in comparison, the boredom of like knowing what's going to happen to you the next day and that you're going to be safe seems you know like a minor thing, sort of, you know. But at the same time, I do think it's a important question. Maybe, you know, the way we're putting it is a little bit of a twist on it, but just like art is fundamental to humanity, even if it's not a matter of daily survival. It matters whether or not a society fosters creativity and expression. We don't like living in societies that don't, right? But even more than that, if socialism will be boring, I think that also implies that it's a society that's stifling innovation and expression, which has deeper consequences than just being bored. It means that there's someone or some class doing the stifling, right? Which is also what's underlying a lot of these perceptions about socialism. And not only that, but if socialism will be boring, if it's an undynamic system that's controlled by some sort of elites, then it's actually never going to be able to compete with capitalism. Because we can call capitalism many names, and it's getting called many names throughout this weekend, appropriately, but boring is not actually one of them. Capitalism's revolutionized the world many times over just in the last 150 years. It's changed how we live, how we communicate, how we think, what we look like, how we express ourselves, which doesn't mean that many of us individually don't experience tons of boredom under capitalism, and I'm going to get back to that contradiction. But the point is that capitalism is a very dynamic system. It's unafraid of change and of reinventing itself, which is really, it's a major aspect of the last, when people talk about neoliberalism, this sort of period over the last 30 years, we've seen capitalism reinvent itself. It's torn down the old sort of stable social welfare state system that it had. It's reorganized where and how people work within countries and around the globe. And it's even taken the anti-capitalist ideas from like the last epoch of revolt in the 1960s, and it's sort of twisted them into like notions of consumer power and entrepreneurial freedom. You know, capitalism is very dynamic in that way. It has moves. Right? And a system like that is not going to be defeated by some sterile top-down system that just depends on the wisdom of a few all-knowing administrators or party leaders. And fortunately, as I think we're talking about throughout this weekend, that's not what socialism is. Or at least it's not the kind of socialism that we fight for in the ISO. It's not the kind of socialism that was written about in the Communist Manifesto. It's not the socialism that's inspired millions of people and revolutions that have happened around the world. That kind of socialism, which we'll be talking about, is socialism from below. That's a creative, dynamic, democratic, flexible system that's all about unleashing the incredible power and potential that billions of people have who are stifled under capitalism today. Workers, people who are oppressed on the basis of gender, religion, race, students, young people, etc. And we've only had a couple glimpses of what that society could possibly be like. You know, really based on the briefest experiences of different revolutions, and the longest one by far being the Russian Revolution from 1917 to, you know, you could time, whatever, to its eventual degeneration in the late 20s into Stalinism. And I'm going to come back to the Russian Revolution, but for now we'll just say there's a lot of things that happened in those 10 years. It was not boring. That was definitely not the word that anybody, friend or foe, was using for it. And I think that's the final reason why to have a meeting on this question, whether socialism will be boring. I mean, it's really just another cute way of asking if socialism is an actual possibility for humanity, which is really very important. We're seeing so many explosions, revolts that are happening around the world in the last 5 years. But that question of, like, what's the alternative? Can anything replace? You know, there's more and more people fed up with capitalism, but so much anger, not so much hope necessarily, or a feeling that another society is possible. So I think it's really important that we're popularizing and building on the idea of a new, exciting vision of socialism that's wildly democratic, it's creative. I said new. It's actually not a new vision. This is the vision that people like Marx, Rosa Luxemburg had, but people like it when you say it's new. So we'll talk about it like it's new. So actually, this is probably the most important question being talked about this weekend. Congratulate yourselves for being here. Everybody else has no idea. Their priorities are totally out of whack. Okay, so before I go on, I just want to mention there's a few different books that got me thinking about this that I'm going to be talking about again and again, and I just kind of like to throw them out at the beginning. One is a pamphlet by Hal Draper, an American Marxist, called Two Souls of Socialism, and that's something that for folks who are really interested in these politics, if you haven't ever read that, that should be like at the top of an immediate list. The other two books are not things I just think are things that people should read at some point in their political lives. One of them is a book by a Marxist who recently died named Marshall Berman called All That Is Solid Melts in the Air, and I'll be talking, which is really about the contradictions of life under capitalism. And the other is a collection of writings by the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky called Problems of Everyday Life, which was about talking about some of the different what issues people were actually facing in the years of the early years of the Russian Revolution. So keep those in mind as I go. All right, so let's start by talking, let's define boredom a little bit, right? Because this is a very serious subject, I did some serious research, I went into the journals, I found in the October 2012 issue of Perspectives on Psychological Science, a paper called The Unengaged Mind, Defining Boredom in Terms of Attention, and I read the abstract of it. I didn't go on. Because in the abstract, they gave a good definition, I think, of boredom. They said, boredom is, well, I'm kind of paraphrasing because it's academic. They said, boredom, it's basically they're saying boredom is when you want to be engaged in some sort of meaningful activity, like either a thought or an action, but you cannot. And it's characterized both by restlessness and by lethargy. And the reason why I'm even giving this definition is just because I like the idea that it's talking about boredom being an active state, meaning it's you have a desire for meaningful activity that's being denied, whether by stuff in your own head or by the society around you. And just to say, boredom, this could be a sympathetic thing or an unsympathetic thing, right? A worker who's bored by her mindless job or the fact that when she's home, she's stuck in the house because she has no childcare, that's a sympathetic thing. The owner, maybe, of her company profiting off her labor, who's bored because he has every possible thing and he's fucking bought hot air balloons and run for the Senate and all that, but is still just bored. That's not so sympathetic to me, right? But both of those very much exist in our society. But then you can also talk about boredom on a more societal level, right? Like living in a society where there's little innovation going on in technology or in culture, which are different things. These individual boredom and societal boredom doesn't necessarily go hand in hand. You know, there are hundreds of years in feudal societies where very little changed, and they're boring in that way. I have no idea if individual, you know, peasants or lords experienced boredom under feudalism, where you think everything, this is the way it's meant to be, this is God's order. I have no idea if people experience boredom in the way we would think about boredom today. Then on the other hand, you've got capitalism, this very dynamic system where boredom, individual boredom, is actually endemic to it. And I wanted to talk a little more about capitalism now, right? In terms of the dynamism of capitalism, the Communist Manifesto has a lot to say on it. People who haven't read the Communist Manifesto are always surprised how much of it is about capitalism and the good things capitalism done, or at least the respectful analysis of it. Marx and Engels wrote in the Communist Manifesto, "Capitalism has been the first to show what man's activity can bring about, people's activity, obviously. It has accomplished wonders far surpassing Egyptian pyramids, Roman aqueducts, and Gothic cathedrals." And then, you know, they go on to then explain what is it that makes capitalism so different than previous societies. And it's the fact that it's constantly revolutionizing society, right? Every previous ruling class before the bourgeoisie, their main concern has been preserving the status quo. Like, we have it good, nothing should change. Capitalists obviously don't want to bring about their own downfall, but they're constantly changing the status quo. This is how the Communist Manifesto puts it in a very well-known passage. They write, "The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation, distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profane. And man, people, are at last compelled to face with sober senses their real conditions of life, real relations with their kind." And this change is just a relentless process under capitalism. They mentioned before how, you know, capitalism outstripped previous cathedrals and, you know, all these the pyramids of Egypt. In Marshall Berman's book, All the Solid Melts in Air, he makes the point that capitalism doesn't even produce things like the Roman Colosseum. It doesn't produce huge monuments that last for hundreds of years, because within a generation or two, whatever gets built just gets torn down and some totally different thing gets constructed, right? And the way the way Marshall Berman puts it in his book, he's a beautiful writer. He talks about, to be modern is to find ourselves in an environment that promises us adventure, power, joy, growth, transformation of ourselves in the world, and at the same time that threatens to destroy everything we have, everything we know, everything we are. I think that captures the contradictions of life under capitalism well. What makes capitalism such a dynamic system? That it's based on two factors, right? Profit and competition. The need for profit means that businesses and economies constantly have to grow faster and faster. Competition means even growth isn't enough, but has to be more growth than whoever you're competing with, right? So that produces just this relentless pace of change. In theory, in capitalist theory, this works out great. It's just endlessly productive. It's based on free competition, and it's incredibly dynamic and exciting. And yet at the same time, most of our lives are quite dynamic in some ways under capitalism, because for most of us, people who are workers, we don't enter that free market by choice. We have to sell our labor to survive, right? And so, which means we spend most of our lives or all of our lives working for other people, which is inherently boring to a great degree. And not only that, but even many of the dynamic innovations happening in capitalism are actually designed just to squeeze more out of us and make our work lives even more de-skilled, dehumanizing, right? And it's really not just our work lives. I mean, you know, has anybody, people watch Louis here, the show? One of my favorite moments in the show, and it's not a particularly progressive thing, or it's not reactionary either, but he's at like a school meeting with other parents, he's, you know, for his kid's school, and all the parents are sitting there talking about like how we can make the school better, and he just raises his hand, he's like, sorry, isn't school supposed to just like suck? Like, how much can we improve this thing, right? And that's obviously not the vision I want my kids' teachers to have or anything like that. But there's a degree to which, yeah, for most people, if you're going into the working class, school is actually supposed to suck. That's the way it's designed to work. You're being trained for that. School is boring for the vast majority of people. Family life is boring for the vast majority of people because we spend most of it engaged in social reproduction for the system, right? If you're a family, if you have kids, two-parent household spends most of their time, sounds like a business conversation. Okay, so you'll do the laundry, I'll take the kids to the doctor, then I'll help them with their homework. It's mostly things that are actually geared still toward furthering the system, and the majority of it's quite boring. Result, we often experience capitalism as a system, as a way of life that's exciting for somebody else. Mm-hmm. We're always reading about exciting shit. We're seeing on the news, or whatever, exciting shit happening to other people, to celebrities, whatever. That's better than nothing. That's better than being individually bored and also living in a society where there's nothing interesting going on. But I think we can do a little better. Yeah, or we experience the excitement, the dynamism of capitalism as something that's just landing on us like a catastrophe, right? You know, innovation has meant that your job is now obsolete, or that your job sucks a lot more because of some new innovation. Or dynamic changes in your neighborhood mean you can't afford to live there anymore, right? You know, it's exciting for someone else, you can go. And that really poses a challenge for opponents of capitalism, because capitalism is always stealing from us the mantle of progress, of being progressive. Think again about something like gentrification, right? You want the neighborhood to still have these shitty services and not have good grocery stores? We're the ones who are innovating it, right? And again, Marshall Berman, in his book, he talks about an earlier version before gentrification, when neighborhoods were being destroyed by building new expressways, and how the opposition to this was similarly painted as like, you're just standing in the way. And this is what he wrote. The developers and devotees of the expressway world presented it as the only possible modern world. To oppose them and their works was to oppose modernity itself, to fight history and progress, to be a Luddite, an escapist, afraid of life and adventure and change and growth. This strategy was effective because, in fact, the vast majority of modern men and women do not want to resist modernity. They feel its excitement and believe in its promise, even when they find themselves in its way. I really like that. I think that speaks to a lot of different experiences that we have. And because the system is constantly changing, it really forces the left, it forces us, we have to be dynamic if we don't want to get stuck looking like we're trying to just hold on to some lame status quo, right? If we don't have the imagination and the energy to be painting our own alternatives. The fight around in teachers' unions and around public education is all about this, right? You take so-called education reform, it's all about capitalists taking the mantle of we're the ones for progress, you know, and for certain leaderships of different teachers' unions and there's this whole divide, right, who don't have the imagination to be actually posing, no, what's the alternative we want of education, they easily get painted as just trying to hold on to the status quo. Here in Chicago, clearly what happened with the Chicago Teachers' Union points to a different way, right? Start, you know, the publication of pamphlet, The Schools Our Children Deserve, which sort of then served as a model for teachers around the country to be like, well, we can actually put our own alternative out about what we want public education to be. That's an example of how we need to oppose the dynamic capitalism. And I would also say that the strike that happened here in Chicago, it showed also not just an alternative vision, but what an alternative strategy is to fighting, right? So instead of union leaders just relying on politicians and networks, you know, to try to get support, it was about relying on teachers and on parents and on students, seeing them as potential leaders in a fight, even if they weren't in that moment. Based on the idea that a fight organized the right way could then develop hundreds or maybe thousands of people into becoming leaders and dynamic people themselves. That gets into what I want to be talking about for the rest of my talk. Because the differences in the way different teachers' unions right now are seeing how you fight, it's not about, I'm not saying that it's about socialism versus not, but that is also related to the different visions historically people have had about socialism, whether it's a process from the bottom up or it's just about a plan worked out by some people from above. And this is where I want to get into the Two Souls of Socialism, the classic Hal Draper pamphlet. This is how he defined the Two Souls of Socialism. Long quote, get ready. There have always been different kinds of socialism, and they have customarily been divided into reformist or revolutionary, peaceful or violent, democratic or authoritarian, etc. These divisions exist, but the underlying division is something else. Throughout the history of socialist movements and ideas, the fundamental divide is between socialism from above and socialism from below. What unites the many different forms of socialism from above is the conception that socialism must be handed down to the grateful masses in one form or another by a ruling elite which is not subject to their control in fact. The heart of socialism from below is its view that a socialism can be realized only through the self-emancipation of activized masses from below in a struggle to take charge of their own destiny as actors, not merely subjects on the stage of history. The emancipation of the working classes must be conquered by the working classes themselves. That was the first sentence in the rules written for the First International by Marx, and this is the first principle of his life's work. And then Draper then goes on to sort of go through what the different forms of socialism from above, which most people think would have nothing to do with each other. So you have, I've already mentioned, you know, sort of Stalinist type regimes in Eastern Europe, or it's still currently in China, North Vietnam, Cuba, Cuba, etc. Where basically socialism means the Communist Party is running the state and it's running the economy. It used to be maybe in the name of development or catching up with the West. Now it's pretty much just in the name of a ruling class holding on to its power, right? That's sort of the classic vision. But he also talked about social democracy, parliamentary socialists, whose idea was that they were going to win power through parliament. Most people don't think of this as being an elitist conception of socialism, but I think there's a quote, Eric Ruder used this in an article in the International Socialist Review that I think it really captures this. It's from Norman Thomas, who was the leader for a long time of the American Socialist Party. He was writing this in, I think, the 40s or the 50s, where he wrote, "The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without knowing how it happened," right? And this conception that, like, we'll have to lead the masses, even if they don't know it, toward socialism, you could see the elitist in that. Clearly the opposite occurred, though, right? Under the name of this kind of gradualism, socialist parties adopted every fragment of the liberal program until one day they were capitalist parties without knowing how it happened. And then the other vision... socialism from above that Draper goes through is utopian socialism, which may seem like it's not very important today, but it really is the seeds, I think, of the concept. The basic idea that, I'll get back to that. Utopian socialism, which was very big in the 1800s, you know, people would create blueprints of rational societies where the world would be run according to what people need instead of profit. And there was this was huge in the U.S. Edward Bellamy wrote this book called Looking Backward that was massively influential, including on later revolutionaries, people like Eugene Debs. And I've been reading it. I wanted to finish it before, but it's long. There's some really good stuff in it. He scores some great points against capitalism. He talks, there's some good chapters about having communal laundries and kitchens and women, women being freed from having to do that work. But the whole society is basically based on this military model where everybody is a soldier of the country and there's these unseen administrators running the system. The people benefit from this, but they have no role in creating the system, right? And in that way, I mean, you see fragments of this kind of utopian socialism today, not in like big drawn out manifestos usually, but just in that basic idea that capitalism's irrational, things would be better if everyone just followed my plan, that which we see all the time. The thing is, all these ideas of socialism from above, they're all just seeing socialism as being about central planning. That's pretty much it. No, not popular control. Central planning is not an inherently socialist idea. There's tons of central planning under capitalism, right? Capitalism, despite the idea of the ideology of it just being free market, decentralized, capitalism's always need tons of planning, tons of government intervention. I mean, we all saw this recently with the bailouts of the banks, but funding for technological research, regulations on business, Obama's health, the healthcare plan to try to ensure that people can at least, get enough healthcare to keep living and keep working. That's kind of all that it may be. provides for. There's always been a tension within capitalism between free market ideas and central planning. You know, we could call it the two souls of capitalism, really. On the one hand, there's always been this sort of entrepreneurial idea, the captains of industry, going back to Rockefeller and Henry Ford or Steve Jobs more recently. But there's also always been the capitalist infrastructure builders, right? The people in New York City, people like Robert Moses, who designed all of New York City, the highway system. People like Robert McNamara in the 60s, who went from heading up Ford to being the Secretary of Defense to the World Bank. Or today, you think about former entrepreneurs, people like Michael Bloomberg or Bill Gates, who went from heading up, you know, the entrepreneurs now to the Gates Foundation, to Bloomberg's vision of redesigning New York, what Bill Gates has done with the Common Core and education. Now maybe, you know, in the past, in the mid-20th century, when socialism from above was a more fashionable thing around the world, some of these types even called themselves socialists, or they said, I'm a little bit socialist. Today, socialism is sort of a bad word among all the ruling class, so it's more that they get accused of being socialist by the more free market ideologues, right? So Obama's healthcare plan is socialist, the Common Core, according to the right wing, is socialist. It's all laughable, right? Even though these things are clearly are all about trying to ensure long, create conditions for long-term profitability and reducing how much is spent on, you know, on our well-being. It's laughable that these are socialists, but I think the point I'm just trying to make is that socialism, different schemes of socialism from above, basically have as much to do with workers' control as things like as anything Michael Bloomberg says or the Common Core. To get back to the theme of this talk, socialism from above, these different ideas, their vision of socialism is boring. It's undynamic. It doesn't tap into the enormous potential that people who are oppressed under capitalism have. George Orwell wrote an essay towards the end of his life about what was wrong with utopias written about in fiction. It was called Why Socialists Don't Believe in Fun, which is a much worse title than Will Socialism Be Boring, by the way, if anybody has a beef with that. But what he was basically writing about was how throughout, even great writers, when they've written about utopias, they're not real. They're these sterile societies that actually sound awful and creepy because they have nothing to do with real human beings. And I think that's an insight into the general tradition that has existed in the socialist movement, you know, of socialism from above, right? And by contrast, our tradition, and I mean that broadly, I don't just mean the ISO, I think was embodied by Lenin, who's accused of not at all being about from below, in his book Left-Wing Communism. And he wrote, "We can and must begin to build socialism not with abstract human material or with human material specially prepared by us, but with the human material bequeathed to us by capitalism. True, that is no easy matter, but no other approach to this task is serious enough to warrant discussion." What we call socialism from, what I'm calling socialism from below, taken from Hal Draper, isn't just about central planning, but it's about democracy. It's not just about democracy, it's about mass participation, right? It's not just about people voting for stuff every 4 years, but active decision making being in the hands of people every day, relying on people to innovate, come up with their own solutions. It's very disruptive, to use stupid buzzword. And I think this socialism has always been the farthest thing from boring imaginable. It's been a little crazy, hectic sometimes, but boring is not what I would say. The prime example, and what I'm going to be talking about, is what happened in Russia after the revolution of 1917, which is the Russian Revolution is often painted as being the very opposite of democratic. It was a coup, it was tyranny, and certainly it did eventually become that under Stalin, but not for a number of years. The very first decrees that the Bolshevik Party issued when workers took power in the revolution weren't ironclad laws. They were basically calling on workers, peasants, and soldiers to continue carrying on the revolution they'd already done and saying you now have official support and sanction from the government. So the decree on land was basically saying, peasants, keep taking over the landlord's estates, right? We would like it if you create communes instead of dividing up the land individually, but you know, we actually don't have that much say over it now. You guys, it's in your hands. The decree on peace around World War I was basically saying, we know we can't trust the generals in the Tsar's army to make peace with Germany, so we're calling on soldiers throughout the army to elect your own committees and make ceasefires with enemy units until that process continues. You compare these types of decrees and how dynamic they are to even some of the most important reforms we've won in this country. Take the National Labor Relations Act, right, and the New Deal, the thing that basically gave government sanction, the right to unionize. That law didn't say workers, form unions, wherever, however you want, create them. No, it created a very elaborate bureaucracy that workers have to go through in sitting down with management if they want to have their unions recognized by the government. That's way more, I don't want to say it's boring, it was an important reform. Yeah, okay. Erase that from the tape. But this kind of popular participation, cool. It isn't just an ideal, it's not just part of the socialist program. It's necessary in revolutions in order to defeat the old order, right? Just another example from the Russian Revolution. Within a month or two of the revolution, the Bolshevik, there was another decree, you know, legalizing divorce. I'm not going to go into the details, but this was in and changing, you know, setting major changes in place for family relations. This is in a very traditional society. People could have made the argument, oh, we have to go slower on this. You know what I mean? Like we're fighting a civil war right now. In fact, that decree gets passed not because, you know, equality of the sexes is just part of the Bolshevik program, although it is, but it's also because the Bolsheviks saw the way they were going to win, defeat counter-revolution, win this revolution, was to be activating half of the population, women, seeing that this revolution is actually for us, right? For we could become leaders in this revolution, which is very much something that happened. Now, it's important not to romanticize this and to say that this doesn't mean that our tradition just says the people are always right. You know what I mean? If only people were running things, they would always do it in the best way. That's really just another version of utopianism. It's something that sounds radical, but it's generally coming from people who are either naive or demagogues who are claiming, and I'm the one who represents the people, so do what I'm going to say. If you look at, if you read Problems of Everyday Life, you know, the articles from Trotsky, it talks about the incredible struggles that were happening as workers and soldiers and some peasants were struggling in positions to try to figure out how to run society. The litany of mistakes, political mistakes, technical mistakes, mistakes from people having no idea what they were doing is pretty massive, right? I mean, they're trying to use newspapers to communicate with people about pretty important things like what's happening with the Civil War and invasions. And newspapers are being printed that are illegible. It's like people are trying to figure out how to do this. And why would we expect anything different? Why would we expect working people, ourselves, to be able to immediately run society like that? We're not trained for any of that shit, right? Everything in our society is designed so that's not the case. From the crap education we get to the racist, sexist ideas that are permeating, right? But socialism from below doesn't seek to solve this by looking to some saviors or a few enlightened people to educate people, right? Marx, early on in his political career, he famously asked the question, well, who will educate the educator, right? What makes you, the lone educator, so much, who gave you the blue pill, right? Why are you able to see through everything that other people can't? By the way, my Matrix reference, is this too late to be made in late Matrix? Like 10 years, okay. Where am I? Right, so the solution instead to that, what we've always seen, is that people can develop and, you know, politically skilled through their own struggle, right? Just as the famous, you know, the famous phrase that the emancipation of the working class is the act of the working class itself, it's also true that the working class can learn to create a new society through its own activity. And this idea of self-activity, that's the heart, really, of the tradition of socialism from below. It's the very opposite idea of what Vonnegut wrote about in Harrison Bergeron, that basically the only way to go is down. You know what I mean? Like the regular, you know, people can't go up, it's just talented people can go down. And I think the roughly 10 years of the Russian Revolution from 1917 to the late 20s, they really demonstrate how much development is possible through self-activity. That's the bulk of what I'm going to be talking about in the rest of the time that I have. You have to keep in mind huge limitations on how much socialism could develop in Russia in this time. It was before World War I, it was an undeveloped country that then went through, you know, the wreckage of that war. So during the period I'm talking about, there was poverty, there was mass starvation happening at times. And secondly, even if none of this was the case and Russia had all these resources, you're only talking about a few years in a period of a transition from capitalism to socialism. So you got, you know, we should, it's still a very limited view. But even given that, I think we could see how much potential socialism had and what a dynamic, exciting society that it could be. Just, I'm going to go through things pretty quickly because I'm going on for a while already. But just because I began again with the artist vision of the boring socialist utopia, just to talk about art for a second, the Russian Revolution unleashed an explosion of art and culture throughout the 1920s in cinema, visual art, dance. Whole fields that were previously just reserved for the elites were opened up to the masses. So you had thousands of people attending concerts, attending lectures, right? The idea that, you know, from Harrison Bergeron that people having special talents would be seen as a threat to equality. I mean, it just, in reality, that was absurd. That had nothing to do with what Russian society looked like. Artists were celebrated. People like Sergei Eisenstein and film became world-renowned. That wasn't seen as a threat to equality. There wasn't any contradiction between appreciating individual artists and the idea that workers who had been denied access to art could also participate and produce more great artists. And if I'm oversimplifying that, people should totally, you know, disagree. To take another example in terms of people's daily lives, people's family life, sexuality, people should check out, there was a talk given here last year that's on wearemany.org by Jason Yanowitz about sexuality and family life in the Russian Revolution. It's amazing because it gives you a real sense just of how much society was changing dynamically in these years. In Moscow in the first year of the revolution, there were more divorces than there were marriages. Deep in the countryside, far from the cities, courtship rituals were going through massive changes. You know, the songs that men and women would sing to each other in courtship, and Jason had a couple of examples where women would sing. The lyrics of songs changed. One song went, "Time was when my husband used his fist and force, but now he is so tender, for he fears divorce." And people's attitudes, activities, sexually, were also going through radical changes, particularly among the younger generations, and there were real debates between the younger and older generations of Bolsheviks, of radicals, about things like, you know, let's give this word casual sex. I don't even know what the word would be. But these were big debates in society. And, you know, in this process, the role of the government, the way the Bolshevik Party saw their role, it wasn't to impose this is going to be the model for social society. It also wasn't to just be completely neutral and be like, well, you know, we'll see whatever happens. It was instead to basically try to encourage initiatives that seemed promising and spread positive examples. So there's an article that Trotsky wrote in the newspaper Pravda in 1923, where he's talking about how, you know, the Bolsheviks, the government wants to create more communal kitchens and laundries, right? So that more women can be freed from the home, but the state is way too poor to be able to build these on a mass scale, right? And so he's talking about how, in the meantime, individual Soviets and different, you know, or councils or even families need to try to experiment and create examples that can be emulated. This is what he wrote. "A thought-out scheme initiated from above, the time is not yet ripe for that, either from the point of view of the material resources of the state or from that of the preparation of the proletariat itself. We can escape the present deadlock at present only by the creation of model communities. The ground beneath our feet must be strengthened step by step. There must be no rushing too far ahead or lapsing into bureaucratic, fanciful experiments. At a given moment, the state will be able, with the help of local Soviets, cooperative units, and so on, to socialize the work done to widen and deepen it." And just to give a little plug for what I think the whole book, Problems of Everyday Life, Trotsky's writing in here where he's describing the process. It is basically the process by which everyday life for the working masses is being broken up and formed anew. And I just want to talk about the broken up part too, because it's living through a revolution is actually chaotic, not just in terms of the threats facing the revolution, but also even down to the intimate details of people's personal relationships. This is how Trotsky, in a different essay, describes what's happening within many families, within many relationships. "Gigantic events have descended on the family, the war, the revolution, and following them came creeping slowly the underground mole of critical thought, the conscious study and evaluation of family relations and forms of life. No wonder that this process reacts in the most intimate and hence most painful way on family relationships." And it then goes to give sort of a series of kind of hypothetical examples, but of things that are happening throughout Russia. A family where there's a husband who becomes radicalized, decides to remove all the religious icons from the house against the wishes of the wife, causes creative, you know, chaos, leads to divorce. A husband and wife who each become communists, but the whole previous basis of their relationship is no longer there. They're both, you know, they're off in political activity. They get a divorce. A wife who joins a communist women's organization is no longer interested in traditional home life, results in divorce. These are all revolutionary things. There's also chaos going on in people's lives, right? And in some ways, it reminds you of what the quote I gave before from Marshall Berman about the experience of capitalism. Remember that quote: "It's an environment that promises us adventure, power, joy, growth, transformation. At the same time, threatens to destroy everything we have, everything we know, everything we are." Of course, the key difference being that when you're talking about a revolution, you're talking about a whirlwind that you're taking a part of, that you have an active part of. What we talked about before with capitalism, it's just happening to you. It's just landing on you. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that, okay, that's cool. But when you talk about what happened in Russia, you're talking about a real revolution involving millions of actual flesh and blood people who were created by capitalism, the real human material, groping their way toward different relationships, a different type of society. It's a pretty thrilling and scary process. And it was happening under horrible conditions in a war-torn, poor country. But I think it shows that this isn't some blueprint utopia. This is a real project that we're engaged in. The last point I just want to make is take it to, actually, do I? Sure, I do. sorry. Just want to finish up a little bit. You know, I think I've decisively proved that socialism won't be boring as a society. But what about today? What about the fight for socialism? Right? I mean, we as socialists can be engaged in times. Years can go by when socialists have very little impact on, you know, things beyond small circles on the left, and that can sometimes feel boring, right? And I think there's people who will, you know, who leave the moment because that's boring. Obviously, there's different points as well. But I think in particular, just in these last couple of years since, like, the Occupy movement and the revolutions around the world, 2011, 2012, I think it's pretty common for people, you know, in this room, on the left in general, to feel frustrated with, you know, sort of having to go back to the same old type of protest, the same old type of political activity. And it's really, and I think, I mean, obviously one of the problems with that is that we can forget that while for maybe experienced activists, this feels like the same old activity, this out for new people just getting involved doesn't feel like the same old anything, right? It's the exciting first steps of questioning everything you know about society. And this is a really old problem for the left everywhere, right? I mean, it's a classic example in the 60s. You have a student going to their first peace protest in like 1967. By 1968, would feel like this grizzled old revolutionary, dismissive of people now going to their first, you know, their first protest, right? Even in the Russian Revolution, in problems of everyday life, Trotsky is repeatedly urging Bolsheviks and new revolutionary journalists to engage with where people are at who are just becoming engaged with the revolution. He writes, the new literary tendencies, and he's talking about journalists here mostly, anxious to keep pace with the revolution, do not concern themselves with the usages and customs based on the existing conception of morals, for they want to transform life, not describe it. But new morals cannot be produced out of nothing. They must be arrived at with the aid of elements already existing but capable of development. To go to another classic response to this comes from a book I've already quoted, Left Wing Communism by Lenin, where he's writing at a moment where the Bolsheviks have won power in Russia, but revolutions throughout Europe have lost. The revolutionary moment's passed, and there's a lot of communists who don't want to leave the streets and go back to activity that they view as the same old boring stuff in their unions or in elections in parliament. And Lenin's response is basically like, yeah, I know, it's frustrating. It's not up to us. That moment's gone. You know, people aren't in the streets anymore. They're in the unions. They're in parliament. We have to go there too, and we've got to patiently explain, that's the phrase he uses, the need for revolution until we get another chance to be back in the streets. And, you know, since then, I think a lot of us have frequently used that phrase, patiently explain, because it's one of the main tasks of being a revolutionary in a non-revolutionary time. It doesn't sound that revolutionary, right? Patiently explain. And it's easy, I think it's easy for some folks to find this to be boring, right? Like, to use Trotsky's words, we're revolutionaries. We want to transform life, not describe it. It's understandable. But at the same time, being bored with ordinary protests or ordinary building in your workplace can easily become being bored with ordinary people, right? Being so focused on your criticisms of the left or a certain union that you're missing the opportunity to talk to a fast food worker taking part in her first act of defiance, right? Which isn't boring at all when you're actually engaged in that process. Or it can be missing the opportunity to be involved from the beginning in something that then will explode into something really dynamic. I'm almost done. I mean, basically, the task of patiently explaining is also about patiently learning. It's about learning how people's ideas are changing around different issues. It's about learning the best way to sharpen your own ideas. But it's also learning about something I think is just and will never be boring, which is about the infinite different ways that people interpret the world around them and figuring out how to engage around that. That is an inherently not boring task for socialism from below, because really I think one of the key elements of our tradition is a deep interest in humanity, in real human beings, not the abstract kind, right? There's a great quote, last quote I'm going to give you from All That Solid Melts Into Air, about Robert Moses, one of these big capitalist developers who helped, you know, design New York City. And a friend of his said about him, "It used to shock me because he was doing all these things for the welfare of the people, but to him they were lousy, dirty people, throwing bottles all over Jones Beach," which he helped design. He loves the public, but not people. The public is a great amorphous mass to him. It needs to be bathed, it needs to be aired, it needs recreation, but not for personal reasons, just to make it a better public. I think that describes, from everything I've heard about Michael Bloomberg, you know, the master public, that describes his attitude toward actual human beings. To a T. That idea of loving the public but hating actual people is also, I think, part of the tradition of, you know, oftentimes of socialism from above, right? Of things that create visions of socialism or societies that call themselves socialists that have more faith in 5-year development plans or blueprints or just we have to win it plans to win the next illusion than faith in the capacity of what millions of people can achieve when they're inspired and when they're liberated, right? And those visions of socialism, frankly, can be dry, they can be boring. I think in contrast, the revolutionary socialist tradition, one way you could sum it up is, you know, when Karl Marx, he filled out a survey sometime, that one of the questions that asked him was, what's your personal slogan? And he took an old Roman saying, "Nothing human is alien to me," right? Which I think should be one of the mottos that we always have. Human beings are not boring. We're fascinating as a species, and so is the society that we have the potential to create when we finally get rid of this one. So, thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.